And now, would you welcome Professor, Nano Professor Leonard Jeffrey.
Okay, bye. Hotep, Hotep, praise the Lord. I'm glad that you're here. And certainly, we want to thank Rob Law for having the foresight to have this special tribute to Nelson Mandela. Let's give him an acknowledgement, a round of applause. And I'm sure we're all still thoroughly impressed by the celebration of the brother's life. It was really impressive. Truly, the people in South Africa celebrated not just Nelson Mandela, the individual. They celebrated the movement of African liberation. And he became the focus, clearly, because he was a specially endowed person. He had what I refer to often as the sacred mission to do something special in life. But we have to realize that 27 years of that life was inside. There was not much he could do but be a symbol. And so the struggle had to be carried on by others who were outside. And that included Winnie Mandela. And I was so glad that they gave her her props and her kudos. And she was dressed in her mourning black. That's not Winnie. Winnie likes to express her African self. But she was dignified and with the other widow, Rashia Michelle. And they showed the strength of the black women. But Winnie was a special fighter in the struggle. When she went, people got stirred up. And she was the first to come out with Nelson, and her hand was in the air. His hand came up after her hand was waving in the air. And so we need to see the great struggle of a people through this individual. And the struggle goes deep. The ANC has deep roots. ANC and the NAACP were born within a couple of years of each other. One 1910, the other 1912. ANC and NAACP and all the various manifestations of our struggle were dealing with the great objective, which was to restore African humanity. And the beauty of the celebration was you saw the African humanity. You saw it at all the levels. And if you had a chance to see the funeral, you saw it in terms of his family. Even the president of South Africa, who's not the strongest of leaders and not the most intelligent or the most experienced, at the final ceremonies, they wrote a fantastic presentation for him. And in that, he gave the sweep of the movement, and he mentioned names after names. So they mentioned not only ANC, the African National Congress, they mentioned PAC, which is an offspring of the African National Congress, and that's the Pan-African Congress. They mentioned the student movement, and that is symbolized by Steve Biko, who gave his life in the struggle. And he didn't have the years that Nelson had to cover so many historical eras. But Steve Biko, just the name sends shivers to me, because I had a chance in 1983, following the dictates of my leader at that time, Dr. John Henry Clark, who said the great book by Cheikh Anta Diop has now been published, 1981, Civilization ou Barbarie, and he said we can't wait 20 years for it to be translated into English like his other works. He said you got to get a sabbatical leave and leave New York and get that book translated. So I got a fellowship to work with the World Council of Churches in Geneva. And so I left New York. I went to Geneva ostensibly to translate this brilliant book, one of the greatest books ever written, in French. I had to do a whole learning process myself in order to deal with the book. It was so difficult. I got on my knees, and as the big man knows, if you get on your knees and you pray strong enough, you'll get your blessings. And so the good Lord had me open my mouth, as I often do, at the right place. And it was a meeting of the leaders of the World Council of Churches. And I was with a special program there called Program Against Racism. And the churches was trying to say that they were not doing enough for struggle in South Africa. And I said, you certainly are not doing enough. And I think you should do more. Fortunately for me, the head of the World Churches was Dr. Philip Potter, who was a boyhood friend of my partner at City College, Professor Edward Scobie. And so he said, Dr. Jeffries, if you don't think we're doing enough for the struggle, although we're doing a lot, I'm going to put you in charge of a task force to help deliver more aid to the struggle in South Africa. And so I said, thank you, Jesus, because I could take the Diop book and put it on the shelf, and now work with getting help from the world churches for the struggle in South Africa. That put me right in this enormous struggle. I had to monitor all the reports coming from South Africa. I had to get all the documents together. Every black spot. You know what a black spot is? Well, in the South African struggle, a black spot is not the stuff you see on television where they're saying, if you got a black spot, you can get some, what is it? Ambi or something, Nadnola, something, some bleaching cream. When you talk about the South African context of the great struggle that Nelson Mandela symbolizes, you're talking about the taking away of black land. Whenever they wanted black land, they declared it a black spot. And they went and they took the land. There was a whole fight over the different communities. Whole communities would declare black spot. That meant the white folks wanted the land. And interesting enough, they recorded this. They computerized their taking of the land. And the black folks resisted. Now, while Nelson was breaking rocks, what did that resistance involve? It involved the women. Women are, unfortunately for Bob and myself, women are rigged up, wired up differently than us. And women will fight, particularly for their children. They'll fight for their homes. And whenever these white folks came to take a black spot, a black community, they wouldn't tell anybody. They would come in the middle of the night with bulldozers, and they would knock these homesteads down. And they would do it again and again. But the resisting spirit that was not captured by the tribute to Nelson Mandela was the women would come back again and again. It was the most fantastic thing. They would knock their homes down, and then before they knew it, the women would find the sticks and the tar paper and wood and whatever, and they put those homesteads back together again. They had to have a place for their children. And the men were not there because the South African economic system said that the black man is going to be super exploited, just like they say it here in our culture. Now, it used to be you pick the cotton and chop the cane, and then you had that peonage after Civil War and Reconstruction, and now you got the black men heading from their house into the street, into the school, into the jailhouse. South Africa's black men were in the mines. The labor system of South Africa needs to be understood. While we celebrate Nelson Mandela, we have to see why he was able to have this feeling for his people in such a way, and what the people did. The women are the key to the liberation in South Africa. Men were in hostels. What are hostels? Not things where the Europeans come with a pack on their back in America and they're going around and they want some cheap housing. Hostels were virtual slave labor camps where the men were recruited to go into the mines, not for a weekend, not for a month, but they had a contract for several years. Those men in the mines, those men working those work camps, had to go every day through the dehumanizing process of having people look up their behinds to make sure there wasn't gold or diamonds in their inners. Men were separated from their families. The most devastating destruction of the black family was South Africa. And as we look at what Nelson symbolized and what he survived, you have to see what the real deal was. Those women had an undying force in them to reconstitute, even with sticks and stones and tar paper, some shelter where they could raise their children. Without the men, because the men were caught up into this labor system. Men were chased out of South Africa. ANC had to leave South Africa when they came up with the program of selective violent activity to complement their Gandhian tradition of direct action, nonviolence. And so many men left South Africa. So how did the struggle continue? It was the women. And to take the image that really is riveting for me, and I put it in the work that I did on Southern Africa with the World Council of Churches, is Steve Biko and the students exploded. They had what they called the Black Consciousness Movement, and they stood up before the guns. So you have the struggle in 1960. That was the famous ANC struggle, Sharpsburg, and the PAC. And Nelson, a few years after that, went into jail. That was the 60 struggle. But then you had the 70 struggle. June the 16th, 1970, the children stood up like Winnie Mandela and the women stood up. And they shed their blood, the blood of the Lamb. Now, none of that was mentioned in all of the celebration. Not a scene, not anything of the black children of Soweto and other townships that were willing to stand up before the guns and get gunned down. Every June the 16th, we should have a celebration in the black world community on the blood of the lambs. And that picture of Hector Peterson, one of the other youngsters, taking them away from the slaughter. And last year, I had a chance to go to South Africa and actually see and feel that experience. They have a memorial. But some of the images we should have seen should have been the memorial of the children who've shed the blood. Then when the system of super exploitation, dehumanization of Africanness got the message that the women were not going to stop trying to be women and family members, that the children were not going to learn the oppressor's language, the language, not even English. They had imposed Afrikaans. That's the language of the Afrikaner. Nobody in the world speaks that. But the few people that represent that community in South Africa, you talk about complete brainwashing of our children. And this hit me because as I began to get the information and the data and whatnot, this control over the mind existed from slavery and post-slavery, exploitation, colonialism. But the Afrikaner people had perfected the destruction of the black community. Now, what am I talking about? The key to control and oppression is the mind. They had their brightest people, and they put the brightest people in charge of the education of black folk, because it was going to be a miseducation. It was going to be education so that you worshiped white folk. It was going to be an education so you couldn't see God as a part of your experience. That South Africa needs to be studied in terms of the struggle of a people, not the glorification of a man from, what did you say, Bob, from prisons to the presidency. There's a whole experience of black struggle that needs to be studied and elevated. We have the children dying in our struggle in America, particularly those four girls bombed in that church. But you had children in South Africa on the move. You had thousands of them willing to move together. We had thousands going into that Around the King movement, and when the adults couldn't do it, thousands of our children. So we need to relate our children struggling in the South with the struggle of the children in South Africa, with the struggle of the women in South Africa, with the dehumanization of the men in South Africa. We have not a clue what Nelson Mandela and the leadership put on us in order to prevent bloodshed of the worst kind from happening in South Africa. Because Nelson lived with these, Kenneth Kaunda, the president of Zambia, at the funeral. He wasn't on the program, but at the last minute, they put him on the program, and so he called them what they were called in the old days, Boers. Even the English-speaking people called them Boers. That's the mix of Dutch, German, French people who were in a struggle in South Africa over who was going to control the wealth of South Africa. And in order to have this struggle, the Boers lost because they didn't have the strength of the English. And the Boers made their trek. The trek meant from the coast into the interior, and that put them in Pretoria and other inland communities where eventually they were farmers, but eventually gold was discovered. All around Johannesburg, you see mountains of the pilings from the gold. You're talking about something 100 feet, 200 feet. So when they discovered the gold, the English followed them and said, "We want that too." So there's been a war between white folks, the Boers and the English. And in order for the Boers to survive, they created a secret society like the English had their secret society. So if you don't know, and nobody mentioned it in all the celebration, the Broderbond. When I did the booklet I did to get out to the world body of churches, there was a section of it dealing with the Broderbond. The Broderbond is the secret society that white folks formed who come from the Dutch, German, and French background. 20,000 men sworn to maintain power no matter what. It was formed to fight the English because the English had their secret societies that are formed on the playing fields of Eton. That's the high school where they train their people, and continued in Oxford and Cambridge. That's their special schools. They develop a manhood, brotherhood in the schooling system. So you had the Dutch fighting the English over the gold and the diamonds. And this Broderbund was formed to fight the English, but then when the ANC, and this is at like 1880, 1890, 1900, the English and the Dutch are fighting and have the Boer Wars. Black people start to get their thing together, and it makes sense. When white folks fight each other, that's when we better get off the plantation. When they're having these wars, that's when we better get our movement going and strengthen ourselves. Eventually, this instrument that they had to beat back the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Cecil Rhodes, they're all tied together. When Cecil Rhodes had his dream, Nelson Mandela had a dream of the unity of South Africa, white, black, Asian. Cecil Rhodes had a dream of white supremacy, and he helped to exploit for the English the gold mines, the diamond mines. And in order to do it, he needed money, millions of dollars of English money. And he would go up to Rothschild, the House of Rothschild, and get the millions of dollars to buy another plot of land of these stakeholders in the diamond fields, etc. It's a fantastic history that you need to understand. So we don't need to be mesmerized by the greatness and the humanity of Nelson Mandela. We need to see a global struggle that has an economic dimension, a political dimension, and a cultural dimension. Economics. South Africa is one of the richest parts of the world, and they intend to keep it in control of white folks. Cecil Rhodes had a deep burning in his belly that there should be an English empire from Cairo to the Cape in South Africa. And his dream was it should be maintained and sustained by a secret society of men of a particular persuasion. Cecil Rhodes' plan was to have a linkage between Cairo to the Cape for the English using Rothschild money. He bought up the Kimberley diamond mines that are in Rhodesia and the gold mines that are in South Africa. So when you talk about gold and diamonds, you've got to see these giant corporations, De Beers and others. So that's the thing that we need to look at. We had a chance to honor Nelson, but we can't let that blind us to the reality. And so if there is a case for reparations on the planet, the best case for reparations is the Republic of South Africa. Nowhere has the stealing of black land been so thoroughly recorded, has the taking of gold, every nugget of gold is recorded, every diamond is recorded, and the slave wages that they pay is recorded. So if there was one place on the planet where reparations could have and should have been raised, it was in South Africa. But Nelson, having spent 27 years in jail, Nelson knowing his own people and their conflicts, Nelson knowing the system that they had of divide up the Africans, find unity among them, whether they're German, French, or Dutch background, but then find division among the Africans, split them off into the Bantustans, and split them off into their own cultures, etc., so they didn't have a unified culture of African people struggling together to raise up Africa. They did this through the school system. This why I fought so hard in the curriculum of inclusion struggle. So Oliver Tambo's wife, he's one of the Robben Island brothers. Oliver Tambo's wife, Adelaide Tambo, would come out of South Africa and go to the World Council of Churches, and then we would sit down and plan how she could use a sewing circle in South Africa as a political education tool. And so we gave aid to her and others to use what seemed to be an innocuous situation of sewing circles that became political education. The thing that has been left out of the picture also is the role of the churches. We think the church role was around Bishop Tutu. No! Bishop Tutu became the head of the South African Council of Churches. But the white folks had done their studies. They knew that the people in the churches inside South Africa, under the tutelage of someone like Bishop Tutu, they was the African fighting family inside, and ANC was the African fighting family outside. And to show how they used the modern technology, I produced a book that went to the World Bodies of Churches called The South African Crises. And in this little volume, what they did was they did a study on, the title was The Struggle in South Africa, and we're talking about a universal moral crisis. So what was hidden from the celebration of Nelson Mandela and his struggles was the universal moral crisis that they scientifically put an education in place to be divisive so we would not be empowered. That they systematically took the land from Africans. Here they are, 15 or 20% of the population, but they controlled 85% of the land. And they actually had a process that Africans are still involved in it. We win the struggle in the bush, on the battlefield. We win the battles. And then we come to the conference table to work it out, and they win the war. That happened in Namibia, Zimbabwe, in Kenya. That happened in South Africa. The process that we win and we want to end the war and the struggle and the death of our people, so let's sit down and talk. And then we don't bring our best minds to talk. We don't bring our most courageous people to talk. And when we sit down, they have their best minds. They got their schemes. They got their plots and their plans. Ian Smith had declared in Southern Africa, so-called Rhodesia, that a black man would not rule in 1,000 years. That was his open declaration to the world. But the people in the bush didn't hear him. And if they heard him, they wasn't paying him no mind. So within 1,000 days, the people in the bush with their armies were successful. And so they formed a patriotic front to get control of their land. But then our people sat down so glad to get out of a war situation that we negotiated that Ian Smith, who had declared there will never be a black ruler in 1,000 years, he was allowed to keep his 10,000 acres. If there was one person who said symbolically has to get out of Africa, that's the one person. And that's the person we said, okay, he can keep his 10,000 acres, and the rest of them can keep their land for 10 years. Here, people have shed their blood, going through all kinds of difficulties, and we negotiated that white folks don't have to give up their lands for another 10 years. When Thatcher got in, the Iron Lady, and others, Reagan and all those folks got into power, when it came time for 10 years to give up the land, they said, well, we don't have any money to give up the land. So whatever plan we had is not going to be in effect. Now, what did we say? Did we say go back to war? No, we said we'll wait. We waited another 10 years. 20 years. People said, Mugabe, he's such a terrible thing. He's doing all this. He's doing what he's doing because the soldiers have said, how many more years do we have to wait? If you don't do something soon, we're going to run you over. The patience that African people are asked to bear under these struggles is a universal thing. And so the South African liberation movement struggle is not an isolated thing. It's a part of a struggle that had been, some of us, our leaders had sat down and they said, we're going to start liberation movements. We're going to support each other in the different struggles in Southern Africa. So what our great brother wanted us to do is to not get mesmerized by us celebrating a great brother without understanding the price that had been paid. Africans understand it because they're still going through it. Our brother knew that Nkatia was the formation of the opposition group being cultivated by white folks to fight the ANC. So if Nelson Mandela and Bishop Tutu hadn't come up with their surprising policy of reconciliation and truth and all of this and that, there would have been a bloodbath between the African groups funded by the European groups before we even got to fight against our oppressor. And so Nelson understood that. So I recognize and appreciate that. But what I do hold against him, and since I'm in this lovely church, I got to at least say the truth that's on my heart. He went to the extreme. African people in South Africa don't know what the struggle was. These youngsters don't know what the struggle was. The people in their teens and 20s and 30s and 40s, they don't have a clue what the real struggle was. And so you don't want to teach them the struggle because you don't want them to become bitter. But the white folks are teaching their people, this is yours. This land is yours. You built it. And Nelson Mandela, he's already agreed not to touch it. See, that's the tragedy. Political rights don't mean a darn thing if it's not tied to economic power. And so we had a chance to get access to the ballot, but we didn't get access to the purse. Somebody said that in this last couple of weeks. Someone said we had access to the ballot. So we stayed in line, miles-long lines, in 94 to elect a black man to make a statement. But political power is not something that's in isolation. You have political power in order to control the economics of your world. System. The first principle of systems is economics. Control over your productive, creative capabilities. And in order to make your systems work for you economically, you have to have politics. Politics is not what politicians do. Politics is what you do to control your economics. But you won't have an ability to make your economics work for you or your politics to work your economics for you if you don't have culture. So my statement for you today is there are three things that you have to put in place to analyze, to organize, and to materialize your power. And that is the relationship, I call it the pyramid or the triangle of power. And so our great dilemma all over wherever black folks are is that they have our mind. Here in Brooklyn, one of the largest, most powerful black communities in the history of the world, is so divided because they have us saying, well, I'm from Nevis. I'm from St. Kitts. Two little islands in the sun. And even you take the bigger islands. I'm from Trinidad. Well, the folks in Trinidad, which is a wealthy island, relatively large, they're talking about, but we don't have nothing to do with those Bush people up in Tobago. Here's one island community with two islands, and they're looking at each other askance. And so here we are, trying to move as a collective family, but we got these obstacles, which is the mind. We're all family. I can't tell who is from Jamaica and who is from Trinidad, who is from Haiti here. We're all family. Doesn't make any difference whether you're light or highly melanized. We're all family. But we are not allowed to understand that. And our great scholar, Dr. Wade Noble, said it best. African people, no matter where they are, black people, no, colored people, Negro people, no matter where they are, suffer greatly from a shattered consciousness and a fractured identity. And so when the Afrikaners got in there with their racists, it's not that the English were not racist, they were racist. We all know that. But when the Boers got in there, they identified with their cultural roots. And when they got full, complete political power, particularly after World War II, that's when they put in all of that dehumanization of African peoples, that there can't be any interracial marriage, that they can't be living in the same, you can't go to school, etc. That whole dehumanizing process is what birthed Nelson Mandela's struggle, and we're not dealing with it. That same mentality allows them to feel that we won't wake up to what the real deal is and make the economic demands. And so hopefully that will happen. We need economic justice to go with the political empowerment that African peoples have. And then don't be afraid of having our societies of secrets where we train our people to go beyond themselves and develop a sacred mission. As Nelson Mandela said, I was a servant of the people. He was trained to be a servant of the people because from his group where he was buried out on the Eastern Cape, African traditions are that they prepare young people who come from the royal lines. And that royal lines don't mean the Queen Elizabeth or anything. They mean the leadership lines. And he was designated as one of, and a royal is not one person, the son of so-and-so. It's a group of the young people who have the potential to be great leaders, and they're trained together. So he came out of that privileged group, but it wasn't privileged. It was a group that, because of your skills and because of your history, what your uncle was all about, what your granddaddy was all about, we expect you to be a servant of the people. We will empower you to take leadership, but your role will be to serve the people. And so that's the African traditional thing. They're talking about a group of maybe 2,000 or 3,000 young men who are in a group to know that you have the leadership potential and we expect you to exercise it. And then when we decide to select the paramount chief or even the king, you'll be in that pool of people who will be expected to go beyond yourself when you take leadership. So Nelson needs to be studied, but the whole study of South Africa needs to be understood. That even to this day, the only person in the South African leadership who I know raises her hand in the tradition of demanding reparations is Winnie Mandela. Bishop Tutu and Nelson had a pact that we will not raise reparations because they knew that there would be disaster if that occurred. But you still have to go to the conference table to say you owe us. There has to be economic equity. That means we get a greater share of the wealth. You can't have these townships that used to be a couple hundred thousand people. Now there are a couple million people, people living in shanties or living in these houses that they throw up over there. They build a couple of million houses, but are they really houses that are part of communities? Or are they just a place for shelter? A house in a community means you have schools, you have other facilities there, you have churches, etc. So see the struggle writ large. See the women in the struggle. Winnie symbolizes that. See the children in the struggle. Steve Biko symbolizes that. See the churches in the struggle. Bishop Tutu's SACC, the South African Council of Churches, the Boers concluded that The South African Council of Churches, the Anglican tradition, and others were the ANC inside in concert with the ANC outside. That's why I say that just to see one man who spent most of the time that the struggle was going on in the jail and couldn't do anything, you have to look at where was the other inspiration. Alan Bosack would come to Geneva, and he was of the Reformed tradition. So the idea was to cultivate him so that he could go back and work on the inside. So they made him a head of the Reformed tradition. That's Presbyterians, etc. And so the Boers were upset that here this brother can go outside and come back and he's a part of the tradition. So what did they do? They set him up. They gave him a secretary. And before we know it, once he was in a prominent position, him and the secretary was going to Sun City or Fun City or whatever. So they got pictures of him doing things he wasn't supposed to do. I'm saying you're up against a system. And it's not one individual or one great hero that we have to deal with. And so that's our call to you, is try to get yourself in a position where you organize your economics, your politics, and your culture. You see each other as a family. You use the value of your churches as centers of your community, but use the home as the place where the knowledge is first dispensed. So we need a culture of liberation, a culture of development. And so we can take the tradition of struggle of Nelson Mandela, see it writ large, and make it a part of our struggle. Thank you, brothers and sisters. And it's my pleasure to be here with you.